Is it going again, Mitch?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was there one of the things that the press tried to elicit from people there was, you know, how did your commanders ever get you in this place? What was the general morale and attitude toward the chain of command? Did the trooper on the line have faith in his the leadership or questioning or what?
No, I don't think there was any questioning in 1-9. Keep in mind that that 1-9's last operation that they were on prior to going to Quezon was at Compiègne. Very similar to Quezon. 1-9 was a very proud battalion. And there was a feeling amongst the old timers or the veterans when I got there that 1-9 was definitely the best battalion in Vietnam. They were an experienced battalion and they were professional. And this is something that I picked up on and that a lot of those replacements picked up on. I think one reason that 1-9 stayed at Camp Evans so long, and I joined 1-9 on the 12th of November. We moved to Camp Evans on Thanksgiving Day. And we were at Camp Evans until we went to Quezon on the 22nd. And the line companies were kind of spread around the area there, but CP was at Camp Evans. And we integrated a very large number of replacements during that time. So there were a lot of people in the battalion when we went to Quezon who had not been at Con Tien, but we had heard a lot of stories about it. So I guess one thing is we went to Quezon knowing what the battalion had gone through at Con Tien, and measuring it against that, we didn't find any different than what they had previously gone through. We got up there and when you saw the thing that we built up there taking shape, and Colonel Mitchell was a very professional Marine. He knew what had to be done up there to fortify that position, and he was well respected by the men in the battalion. He had written a Christmas letter to the families of every Marine in the battalion. He personally signed every copy of that letter and sent it out. And that left its mark on the men in that battalion. And I still have that letter in here. But we didn't feel that the leadership at battalion level was deficient in any respect. Now, I didn't like that company commander, but that was for other reasons. And our communications officer was probably not the best in the world. He looked out for goal number one before he did the troops. But the leadership at battalion level was as good as it can.
How about the overall sense of mission while you were at Quezon?
Well, as I said previously, most of us had never heard of Quezon before we went up there. And after we got there, we very quickly found out what was happening. Myself and a lot of people, I had read a lot of Marine Corps history, and I had read about Guadalcanal and Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Chosin Reservoir, and at that particular time I thought, gosh, you know, to be a Marine is great. This all may sound a little warped, but that's what I thought at that time, and I still think it's a great extent. And to have an opportunity to see the Marine Corps in combat is something else. But to have the opportunity to participate in a battle that is going to go down in Marine Corps history along with those other battles is something that not everyone gets an opportunity to participate in. And as that battle unfolded, I really did not know that that is what was happening to me. I really did not know what was taking place in the States, in the media. And I've never really talked with my folks about, you know, what they must have gone through at the time, knowing I was there. But I think a lot of the Marines had that feeling up there. Gosh, so much of Vietnam was just patrolling in the jungles and never seeing anything. And here we were with a reinforced regiment sitting there with all the air and artillery support you could ask for, and we were ready. You know, it got to where we were wishing that, well, maybe tonight something will happen. But unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, it never did.
What do you mean? It never did. Something did happen. Was it a lesser battle than was expected, or did the air power knock them out, or what happened?
At least for us in Bravo, Alpha Charlie and Delta, you know, they went over and assaulted 471. They took the hill. They repulsed a fair-sized counterattack. There were probes of the lines at Quezon. But when you find yourself in a position where you're surrounded by it, you know at least two divisions of NVA, and you know that their intent is to take the ground that you're standing on, you're expecting a pretty good-sized attack, particularly when you got 6,000 Marines sitting there just waiting to slug it out with them. And that never materialized. We had the incident with Alpha's outpost out there, and then we had our OP that was assaulted. We had the incident in the clearing operation when we lost all those guys. But as far as a large-scale set-piece battle, that didn't happen in Quezon.
Why not?
I think probably the supporting arms. Well, you know, that's conjecture on my part, because who really knows what the NVA's intention was at Quezon. If their intention really was to overwhelm Quezon as they did at DMB and Phu, then I would have to give the supporting arms the credit for breaking that. Probably the B-52s. Which is, I hate to give credit to the Air Force, but I'm sure if those were Marine Corps planes, we'd fly a lot better. But I think supporting arms, if that was their intent, broke it.
I think most people, you know, that seems to be the consensus. Just a few more questions. Well, you were, of course, over there, but after you came back and you watched the war on TV, did you feel that something was left out? Was it slanted? Was it objective? Was it showing you the war that you had seen?
Well, I guess a yes and a no to that question. You know, you can watch CBS or any of the others, and you're going to see the small unit actions on there. They had guys go out in the jungle with them. Most of the time, though, you find that reporting was somewhat negative. All the dope that after I came back was so highly publicized. I may be extremely naive, but I know of two guys who smoked marijuana shortly before I left over there. Prior to that time, I sincerely did not know of any of it that went on. Of course, we were somewhat isolated. We weren't around civilians much for anybody to be able to purchase it, so maybe that had an effect on it. The media seemed to want to harp on that too much. The one thing that bothered me when we were at Quezon, and Quezon did bother me to one extent, that I thought, if we've been over here fighting this long and they can still mount this type of offensive, then we've got a problem yet. And that was heightened when Puebla was taken too. And we found out about that because a lot of people had the feeling that this war's going to get a lot bigger. So we had that weighed on us somewhat psychologically. But as far as the media reports, when I got back, just the overall negativism of them, and the fact that instead of trying to show what these guys were accomplishing, they tended to look for the negative points. And everything, you know, after I got back at that particular time, I came back in the first part of December 68 and got out in May of 69. And you know, 1-9 was the first battalion to be withdrawn. That was the first American troops to come out of Vietnam. So I felt like that maybe whatever link I had had with it had been severed at that point. And then after that, you had the incident, I remember the 101st Airborne, the Hamburger Hill deal, how they harped on that. Then the thing with Cowley broke. And I remember I had a lot of conversations with a lot of people then, and a lot of people thought that everybody that had been over there was a Cowley. And they couldn't understand how anything like that could happen. And in myself, I'd have to say that, you know, I'd sure have to think twice before I did something like that. But I think you've got to put yourself in the situation of those people to understand why it happened.
Well, did you
I don't
ever...
know if that answers your question.
Yeah.
But,
well, of course, it answers it from your point of view. Did you feel that people back home understood what you had done, appreciated
no.
it as you sorry.
No, not at all.
Why not?
When I came back, I've got a letter here to one of my friends that I wrote to him. When I dropped out of school, my closest friends stayed in school. None of them were eager to enlist or go anywhere. They just didn't want to have anything to do with it. And one of them did something to get high blood pressure, so when he took his physical, he wouldn't be drafted. And I had some close friends killed at the caisson, and after that happened, I remember I wrote him a letter. It's in here somewhere, but I told him, I said, you just best thank God that there's somebody over here that's taking your place. And I don't know if I was justified in telling him anything like that or not. But when I got back, there was a wall between us that hadn't been there previously. I remember when I got off the plane at El Toro and I got on the bus going to LA International, and the first miniskirt I saw, I couldn't believe it. And I'd only been gone a year, but in that year, this country changed so much. You know, there were people speaking out against the war the summer of 67, but it was nothing like when I got back. And you know, long hair really came into fashion amongst a large portion of the populace in that time, too. Before I went over there, it was mostly just hippies that had long hair. When I came back, a lot of these friends of mine had long hair. And there was just some alienation there that I couldn't explain. And much later, they all told me that, boy, when you came back, you were strange. You just didn't want to have anything to do with anybody. But I found that they couldn't understand what had gone on over there because they had not been there. But I also felt that they didn't want to try to understand what had gone on over there. And again, you're extremely isolated over there. You just don't know. I never knew what the media presented over here. And they had seen that. And they had seen that side of it, and I did not. And it took an awful long time for me to get over that.
Why? Well, I guess the question, this I don't expect to have the answer, but why did they not see the experience as you saw it?
They weren't there.
But you see, the point is, though, that it was supposedly a television war. The television brought, this is the cliche, the television brought the war into the living room. The people lived with the war, that they were closest to the war, in this particular war, than any other, or at least that, as I say, is the cliche. And I guess I would ask you, was this a television war? Or was this...
Sure, there's no question about it that it was a television war. But what came across was probably, at least from my point of view, it was probably not what the whole picture was. If I went and saw the war as it happened, and America stayed at home and saw it on television, and we both had different perceptions of it, how could I be the one who had the wrong perception? It's a difficult thing to quantify and to really express, not having seen what me presented during that period of time.
Well, let's go at it another way. What did you see that they did? Experience. I'm not expecting some sort of magical answer, because this is something that everybody's asking now, and no one has answered. Okay.
Maybe it's not. Maybe I'm trying to focus on the wrong thing. One of the things that I felt when I came back was that I had focused on the very basics of life, just pure survival. I got back to the States, and these people were worried about keeping every hair in their head in place with hairspray. I've never seen a man use hairspray before. When I got back to the States, everyone was using it. And the things that they were concerned with in life were so mundane. And I had been somewhere where the thing you had to be concerned with was your very survival on a very, very basic level. These people couldn't appreciate that. I think that's one of the things that's come out of Vietnam, that's come out of no other war. And I look back on it and I say, why? Because guys in Korea, guys in World War II, they experienced this same thing. But for some reason, it's had a much more telling effect on this generation. I find other people, other veterans, that feel the same way. Or that felt the same way. And I'm not sure I'm 100% over that now.
Okay, this is the next thing. What are some of the things in your current life? Well, let me ask you a specific question. Did your experiences affect your dream life?
I had two dreams about Vietnam when I came back, and I'm thankful I've had no more. And one of them really wasn't about Vietnam. One of them was dreaming about going through boot camp again, and I woke up telling myself, God, I made a mistake re-enlisting. So the second one, I had a dream that I was in a foxhole, and there was an unexploded grenade laying there with no spoon on it. And I woke up before it went off. But it just terrified me. And that's the only dream I've had. Now, there had been other instances for a long time after I came back. When I'd go outside at night, I'd look at the moon and I'd think, this is an excellent night to be mortared. When I'd hear a popping noise off in the distance, I kept myself from hitting the ground. That I didn't find difficult to control, but I'd say to myself, it sounds like a mortar, or it sounds like artillery.
Any other, you know, I guess we would say, not dramatic, but things that pop up in your day, or did pop up in your life that can be translated back to the Vietnam experience? You say other people have been touched by this, more concerned with the essentials, different attitude toward nature, communicated dreams.
Well, I think I've seen a lot of people that are able to focus now on the things that I was going to say really matter in life, and I'm not sure that's a good choice of words, because they focus now on the things that are more essential to survival, and they're able to just look beyond the minor problems that some other people focus on, and that can be both good and bad in doing that. But, my wife worried about repaneling this room for a long time, and I granted that it needed repaneling, but that was not something that I deemed totally essential to have done. I don't know, I'd have to sit and think about that for a while to come up with some specific items to talk about, but it's just in general not feeling the need for having so many material possessions, I suppose, that life can be lived quite easily without a large number of things. If you can carry what you need in a pack on your back, there's not very much that you have to survive. And I don't know when to get over that. Maybe I should have gotten over it a long time ago.
What do you think people your age who didn't go over lack that insight?
Yes. Yes. These close friends of mine, one of them ultimately went in the Air Force as a navigator, and he is out now. The other one never went in the service, and I don't think he shares that same feeling with me. Though he and I are again real close friends. We grew up together, and we just, at that time in our lives, we went different paths.
This is this is sort of thing I would, of course, personally totally agree. You've had no negative reaction to you as a Vietnam veteran.
Mm-hmm. No.
Not others who have had such things. I told them a bit of mine.
I am the only Vietnam. I'm an accountant and work for the Electric Utilities in Fort Worth. I am the only Vietnam veteran in the financial department. Anyway, there are a few others in the company.
Can I ask you just a couple of questions? Do you remember any music? And these are really going to be the last few. Do you remember any music of the period?
Oh gosh, yes.
And what was particularly important while you were at Case Hump? Like
music wise?
Like you're a radio man, so you must have an ear for.
Well, I don't think there was anybody who took a radio up there, as I recall. In fact, I've got a cassette in there that I've got labeled 1968 favorites that were the ones played on AFVN mostly. I don't recall anybody taking a radio to Quezon, but there were a couple of radio men who would turn it up to the top of the dial, and this was subsequently really, turn the radio up to 75, 95. And play music on it, which was totally against the rules. But there were I remember a lot of songs after K-Song. But we just did not have that much music up there. Now there were some, I know in 26 Marines, there were some fellow from my hometown that I didn't know that dated the daughter of a lady that I worked with when I had a part-time job when I was in school. And we had two landlines running into Quezon proper. And one day I was sitting there in the company CP, and the phone, we had a landline going to the battalion COC, which then in turn went to the regimental COC in Quezon. And this guy was a wireman for in regimental headquarters company at 26 Marines. And he said, "Hey, I got a letter from so-and-so, and she said you were up here, and I don't know you, but I just thought I'd call you." And we tied up one of those landlines for an hour, I guess, just sitting there talking. So. We had another humorous segment, I recall, when we first got up there. We had a lieutenant. His name was Michael Walker. And he was the 81s. He ran the 81s, and he was a super fella. And he liked to horse around on the radio. And I really didn't know him until this incident occurred. But I was calling around for radio checks, and I called 81s and asked them, and he said, "Roger, I hear you Lima Sierra Lima." And I called him back, and I said, "I don't understand Lima Sierra Lima." And he said, "I hear you lovely, simply lovely." And I called him right back, and I said, "Be advised that this is a control net. I am net control, and you will observe proper radio procedure." And I was totally within my rights to do that. And he said, "Roger, out." And about a week, 10 days went by, and in the meantime, I moved to Bravo. And as I mentioned, that 81 platoon was split. He was with the section that was there by Bravo, and he came up to our CP one day. And he recognized my voice from having heard it on the radio. He said, "You're the guy that calmed me down that night, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." And we were the best of friends after that. So.
I want to ask you a specific question. Have you seen The Boys in Company C?
Yes, I have.
Any comments on it?
I thought the best part of that movie was when they were in boot camp and the drill instructor was calling cadence. And that cadence was as real to the boot camp drill field as you could get. Beyond that, I thought the movie was lousy. I thought it tried to emulate MASH to begin with that absurd soccer team at the end. And though some of those incidents that were in the movie did occur, they tried to cram so many different events into such a short period of time that to someone who had been there and seen it, it came off as being a bit absurd. I recall in boot camp when they supposedly took them down to the airfield to unload the planes, that doesn't ever happen. The gear that they were wearing was a mixture of gear. It wasn't all Marine Corps issue. And it was also rushed. It didn't make sense to somebody who had been there and seen it.
Okay, how about Coming Home? Did you see that?
Yes, I did. I'm not a Jane Fonda fan, and that tainted my opinion of the movie some, I suppose.
How about the portrayal of the Marine Corps? Who went to battle, that sort of thing.
No, the part that, what's his name? The guy
Bruce
played
Stern.
Bruce Stern played. I think some people came back feeling that. But there was a negativism about that, too, the way it was portrayed in there. And I came across feeling that the Marine Corps was portrayed as a bunch of bumbling murderers, too. And that's not true. But have you read Born on the 4th of July? I never really appreciated the problems of someone wounded in that manner until I read that book. But that experience turned him off to the Marine Corps so badly that... And I look at it from the perspective of somebody who wasn't wounded, too. Maybe if I were wounded, I would feel that way. But I had a lot of close friends who were killed at Quezon. My best friend I put on a medevac chopper with a shattered hip one night. And, I don't know, it didn't affect me the way it did those people.
How about The Deer Hunter?
The Deer Hunter was, combat scenes were pretty realistic in it. I think that was entirely plausible. The Russian roulette part, that may have gone on in Saigon. I never got to Saigon, but I found it pretty hard to believe. The person I had the most sympathy for was the blonde that was in love with the guy who finally blew his brains out. She just didn't know where to turn. And I had more sympathy for her than I did for either one of the soldiers.
What would you say had been left out of the war experience by the three films?
Oh, a lack of concern for detail, and that is a narrow point of view because I tend to look for that. If I can't look at it and it looks real, then I don't feel any realism in it. If I'm going to see Marines with Army gear, then I know that nobody's paid any attention to it. If I see somebody fire 3.5 and there's another guy standing right behind it when he fires it and he just keeps standing there, then I know there's something wrong. That destroys the movie for me if it's not authentic. The Deer Hunter, to me, could have been a very authentic movie if the end had been somehow different. I could understand the Russian roulette while they were prisoners. And I thought the prisoner scene was very realistic. But like the boys in Company C, to try to cram so many events into a movie, it came off to me as all make-believe. Have you read the book POW?
No.
It's an excellent book on POWs to be able to understand their side mm-hmm. of the war.
Yeah.
That just thought came up when I was talking mm-hmm. about the POW sitting there.
Well, I don't. Is there anything that we've left out of the discussion as far as.
I was going to tell you about the comments I had on your position paper.
Yeah, fine. This is great.
Some of these are very minor, but I.
That's all right.
You might want to know about them. You
sure.
might not.
You this was written, by the way, this paper was written about a year ago. Mm-hmm. So I've done a lot of work since then, including a whole summer in Washington and, you know, a further reading as well.
General Loewen. Right, is that how you pronounce his name?
Loewen, yeah.
You put in here that he's dressed in a protective flak jacket supplied by the U.S. Marines.
Uh-huh.
I think he was wearing an Army flak jacket.
Oh, really?
In that picture.
Go for the details.
On page 13, you said Ed Needham of NBC covered the evacuation of Quezon Village on the 24th of January.